Well, thank you, Brother Jeff. And good evening, everyone, brothers and sisters and young people. We're going to have a look at Nahum chapter 2 tonight. So we'll spend most of our time there and just wander around the Bible a little bit, but not that much. 3 weeks ago, we had a look at the first chapter of Nahum, which in a nutshell could be described as Nineveh's doom declared. This was the declaration by God that the wicked capital city of Assyria was doomed to be destroyed. This proclamation was written by Nahum, and that was probably around the year 650 BC. Then 38 years later, the prophecy of Nahum came true in 612 BC when Nineveh was destroyed. So now this second chapter of Nahum actually describes the destruction of Nineveh. The details of how Nineveh was destroyed and how that event fits in with this chapter are quite interesting. There was an allusion to how it would be destroyed in Nahum chapter 1 in verse 8, where it says, "With an overrunning flood he will make an utter end of the place thereof." And now in chapter 2 we get a few more details of how that all happened, or how it would happen. So in the first five verses of this chapter 2, we have the arrival of the enemies of Nineveh. And we have the prophet Nahum, God talking through the prophet, and telling the Ninevites to defend themselves. And in the King James Version, it says, "Keep the munition," which seems to be a reference to armaments. Keep the munition. In the English Standard Version, it reads, "Man the ramparts, watch the road, dress for battle." So here God is telling Nineveh to be ready. In actual fact, God is, through the prophet, taunting the Ninevites because God is directing this attack. And the Babylonians and the Medes who are doing the actual warfare are really pawns in the hand of God. And he intends to punish the residents of Nineveh for their sins. And this is quite common, I believe, in various parts of the Bible where God, through his prophets, will taunt those he intends to punish because of their wickedness. For example, the prophets of Baal. Remember the 450 prophets of Baal in 1 Kings. Elijah taunted the prophets. And, of course, this was an inspired taunt by Elijah. He said, "Cry aloud, for he is a god." That is, Baal is a god. Either he's musing, or he's relieving himself, or he's on a journey, or perhaps he's asleep, and he must be awakened. So this is a taunt, really. And when they failed in this hopeless task of trying to bring fire down upon their sacrifice, of course, Elijah took the 450 prophets and slaughtered them all at the brook Kidron. We have another taunt in Ezekiel 38, where the northern invader is taunted by God. Ezekiel 38, verse 7, we have the phrase, "Be thou a guard unto them." Speaking of the allies of the northern invader, be a guard, knowing full well that Gog, the leader of this invading force, will be destroyed. And Ezekiel 39 tells us that thou shalt fall upon the mountains of Israel. But the taunt was there. And the Ninevites are also warned in this taunting fashion, that their fate was sealed despite any effort that they might put forward to avert the Babylonian invasion. Now, God has always used the enemies of Israel to punish the Jews when they were disobedient. And we would possibly ask the question sometimes, if this was God's intent to use them to punish Israel and Judah, why would God in turn punish Assyria for doing what he wanted? Well, the answer is that quite often the nations that were used by God did not give God the glory. They didn't recognize that God was in charge. And they usually went too far in what they were doing. And they also blasphemed the name of God in the process. So they had turn had to be punished. Nahum chapter 2 and verse 2, we have a message of comfort to Judah. God was about to restore the pride of his people, Israel, by defeating Assyria. And for a short period of time, this pride, this proper worship of God was restored through Josiah. And in the same verse 2, we have the Assyrian policy of emptying countries mentioned, taking the natural inhabitants and putting other inhabitants in their place, like they did with the northern kingdom of Israel when they took them into captivity and then replaced them with other people in 722. That sort of thing was going to come to an end. Assyria wasn't going to be allowed to do that anymore. The vine branches are mentioned there in verse 2. Israel and Judah. These vines had been severely marred by Assyria, and that was to stop. So these would be words of comfort to Judah by Nahum. And as we said, the guilty party, Assyria, had been guilty of many things, and besides blasphemy, they wanted to depopulate various countries, and they went beyond what God wanted them to do. He just wanted them to punish Israel and Judah, and they went beyond that. And in fact, Assyria was promoting immorality to the extent equivalent to Sodom and Gomorrah. And this, of course, was also detestable to God. So if you were a resident of Nineveh in those days, 612 BC, what would you see? Well, if you were able to see over the 50-foot-high walls, if you had a vantage point somewhere, you would see hordes of Babylonians all dressed in red, as we read there in verse 3 of this chapter, having red shields and red spears and red chariots glittering in the sunshine. And in the nighttime, there'd be red torches shining on their armor. That would have been a very fearsome sight. And red was the color of Babylon, whereas blue was the color of the Assyrians. Let's have a look at Ezekiel chapter 23. Ezekiel 23, where we see these colors of the uniforms mentioned. Ezekiel 23, verse 5 and 6. And Aholah played the harlot when she was mine, and she doted on her lovers, on the Assyrians for her neighbors, which were clothed with blue, captains and rulers, all of them desirable young men, horsemen riding upon horses. So they were dressed in blue, the Assyrians. Then you go down to verse 14 and 15. Then it goes on to say, and that she increased her whoredoms, for when she saw men portrayed upon the wall, the images of the Chaldeans portrayed with vermilion, which is a red color, girded with girdles upon their loins, exceeding in dyed attire upon their heads, all of them princes to look to after the manner of the Babylonians. of Chaldea, the land of their nativity. So there we have just one reference that indicates the colors of the two different empires. So that's the way Nahum saw it. Approximately four decades before it happened, and the Ninevites would be looking over the wall and seeing these red-attired Babylonians coming at them. You go to Nahum chapter 2, verses 3 and 4. We read there about the red and the scarlet colors. And then verse 4, the chariots shall rage in the street. They shall jostle one against another in the broad ways. They shall seem like torches. They shall run like the lightnings. That's what they would see. That's all happening outside the walls, the broad ways outside the walls. And then in verse 5, he shall recount his worthies. They shall stumble in their walk. Now this is the king of Assyria, King Sin-Sharish-Kun, eventually comes to his senses. He's been very busy with an orgy. And he comes to his senses, waking up to the fact that Nineveh's in trouble. So he calls his generals together, his worthies, and they shall make haste to the wall, but they stumble. They go to the wall, and the defense shall be prepared. Now for 3 years, ever since 615 B.C., Nineveh had been under attack. And now it was 612. And they figured, well, there's no real problem. They won't be able to break through the wall, but it looks like they were getting through, and the king calls his officers to action. But they'd been involved with this drunken orgy, so they were stumbling. And when they get to the wall, they see the Babylonians and the Medes. What are they doing? They're riding on rafts on the Kosa River. They're equipped with battering rams mounted on rafts. And they attack the Nil-Lil Gate. You have a map in your handout showing where the Nil-Lil Gate is, where the Kosa River is, and the Nil-Lil Gate was about to collapse. In fact, 2 miles of Nineveh's walls did collapse, and there was 8 miles of it altogether. In verse 5 of Nahum chapter 2, it says, the defense shall be prepared. Now, this isn't a defense of Nineveh, but it's a defense of the people on the rafts. It's a covering. It's a portable storming cover so that any arrows or rocks could not be thrown down upon the soldiers manning the battering rams, the Babylonians and the Medes. Then we get to verse 6. We find that the wall finally is breached. And let's just read verse 6. The gates of the rivers shall be opened, and the palace shall be dissolved. We're going to look at your handout notes against the verse numbered 6 at the top of the second page on your notes. Now, these are the opinions of archaeologists concerning what really happened when Nineveh fell. And it sort of helps to explain Nahum. Now, one of the opinions is this, that the dam gates controlling the Kosa River were located up here. They were located upstream from the wall. There's the Nil-Lil Gate, and there's the Key Gate. So the Kosa River ran through, I guess that's working, they ran through the city, and out the Key Gate, and then into the Tigris River. That was the course of the river. These were the dams that were upstream from the gate. And it was those dams that were closed by the Medes and the Babylonians. And it cut the water supply off and also created a terrific head of water, a head that was then released against the walls. against the Nil-Lil gate and the wall beside it. And with the battering rams and the pressure of the water, the wall did collapse. That's one opinion. The other opinion is that the Kosa River was used to create at least a moat all the way around the city of Nineveh. This Kosa River was controlled at the key gate. And the key gate was the key gate to control how high the level of the moat water was. But in the year 612, this Tigris River overflowed its banks. And the result was the water backed up into the moat and destroyed the key gate and caused too much water to go around the walls, which again caused the undermining of the walls around Nineveh. Now, the circumference of the wall around Nineveh was 8 miles, 8 miles all the way around. And this Diodorus Siculus, a historian, suggests that 2.2 miles of that wall were destroyed. It was a big wall. It was 53 feet high. There was 20 feet of stone on the bottom and then another 33 feet of mud brick, and it was 49 feet thick. So that was a lot of wall to destroy. So you have to believe that the hand of God was involved here. God rules in the kingdom of men, gives it to whomsoever he will, and God destroyed Nineveh, really, using the Babylonians and Medes. Then in verse 6, it talks about the palace. That word palace is hekel. It can mean a large public building or a temple. And it was dissolved. Dissolved. That has to do with heat. And it means to melt. It's the word mug in the Hebrew. To melt, to consume. And again, the archaeological evidence indicates, as you see on your notes, a great palace fire. A palace fire, because upon learning that the wall had been breached, this king, Sin-Sharish-Khan, the king, in order to prevent or to avoid being abused by the Medes, he got all of his concubines and his eunuchs and his treasures into the palace and set the palace on fire, committing suicide. Dissolved. All of the treasures were dissolved, the metals, the gold and the silver. And that's what this verse is telling us in verse 6. Now, was that the end of the Assyrian Empire? Almost, but not quite. Not the absolute end, because this king died in the palace fire, but he was replaced by another king, this king's name being Ashur-Uballit II, and he was replaced for approximately 3 years. And during that time, from 612 to 609, 608, he tried to regain control of Nineveh, but failed. And it's this effort that we read about in our Bibles that the Pharaoh, remember Pharaoh, king of Egypt, came up to help the Assyrian king fight against the Babylonians, and who died that we remember? Well, we remember that it was Josiah. Josiah, the king of Judah, died in the effort to prevent these Egyptian forces from coming up to help the king of Assyria. If you'd like to have a look at 2 Kings chapter 23, verses 29 to 30, you read about Josiah going up to help. And I won't read it out of the King James. I'll read it out of the English Standard Version. And it says this: "In his days, Pharaoh Necho, king of Egypt, went up to the king of Assyria." The King James Version says Pharaoh Necho went up against the king of Assyria. But that's not the case. He didn't go against the king of Assyria. He went to the king of Assyria, and together they were to help each other defeat the Babylonians. And, of course, King Josiah went to meet Pharaoh Necho and died at Megiddo. So four things happened. Four things happened in quick succession in the year 608 and 609. The last king of Assyria died. Josiah, king of Judah, died. And the king of Egypt, an ally of Assyria, was defeated by the Babylonian Nebuchadnezzar. And the Babylonian Empire, which started around 625 BC, trying to usurp the authority of the Assyrians, finally succeeded and became a well-established power. But let's get back to Nahum at verses 6 and 7 and read those two verses. The gates of the river shall be opened, the palace shall be dissolved. And then we have in the King James something which wasn't read in the platform tonight. It says in the King James, and Huzzab shall be led away captive. She shall be brought up, and her maid shall lead her as with the voice of doves tabbering upon their breasts. Huzzab. Huzzab is mistress in other versions. And it's, instead of being a proper noun, they translate it as a mistress, based on the premise that the king of Assyria would have a queen who would be humbled by the Babylonians. And the English Standard Version states that. It states this. It says, its mistress, the queen of Nineveh, if you like, is stripped. She is carried off. Her slave girls lamenting, moaning like doves, beating upon their breasts. But remember what happened? The king committed suicide, mass suicide with his concubines and possibly his wife. And Huzzab probably means something else other than mistress. And in the margin of your Bible, you might have other ideas. It's that which was established in my margin, that which was established, Huzzab. And so Nineveh is being personified here as Huzzab, just like Egypt was personified as Rahab, just like Jerusalem was personified in Isaiah 29, verse 1, as Ariel. So here Nineveh is personified by Huzzab, or that which was established, because Nineveh was a well-established, well-fortified city, and Nineveh was about to be destroyed. And that would have resulted in the maids tabbering upon their breasts, because it's an indication of distress when they beat upon their breasts or their microphone like that. And just like in Luke chapter 18, verse 13, the sinner, the publican, beating upon his breast, saying, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. That was a practice. We don't seem to do that in our own society. Now, the maidens in 612 B.C. would have been in very great distress because the Babylonians and the Medes were very cruel, and they would have shown no mercy to these ladies. In verse 7 of Nahum 2, it talks about them being taken captive. And when it talks about captive, the word captive is really, the literal meaning means to be uncovered or exposed. And if you read Isaiah 20 and verse 4, you can read there how the Assyrians did exactly that to their captives. They stripped them bare and then led them away captive, uncovered, exposed. And now the tables were going to be turned. The Ninevites were going to find that they would be on the receiving end of this sort of activity. Retribution, just retribution, was going to take place. In verse 8, we have a reference to a a pool of water. Nineveh of old is like a pool of water. What does that mean? Well, the word water in Revelation 17 and verse 15 is a symbol for peoples and multitudes and nations and tongues. And Nineveh was like a pool of water in this sense, that the capital city of Assyria was Nineveh, and it represented the entire empire, which encompassed waters, in the sense that the Assyrian Empire extended right from the Persian Gulf to Cyprus in the Mediterranean Sea, right from the valley of the Tigris River in modern-day Iraq, right to Egypt, the Nile River. That was a big pool of water. Many people resided in that territory that we've just described. And that pool of water, that empire, was about to dry up, says Nahum. And we can see in verse 8, the officers have come to their senses. They're stumbling around, a little bit drunk, but they're shouting. They're saying, "Stand, stand." But do the soldiers stand and fight? No, they flee for their lives. And we'll have another look in chapter 3 about these officers next Thursday. But verse 9, we have the Babylonians talking to each other. So it was a very difficult place to be, Nineveh, in those days, shouting and armies rushing back and forth and so forth. And the Babylonians were shouting now in verse 9, "Take the spoil of silver and gold." And Nahum saw this in vision 38 years before it happened. And the temples and the palaces of Nineveh would be storehouses for spoil that the Assyrians had taken from all the countries that they'd conquered. And this spoil was now being taken by the Medes and the Babylonians. In fact, that palace that the king burnt down upon himself, the gold and the silver melted, apparently they went through the ashes and gathered all of the silver and the gold and carried it to Media, according to the historian. Verse 9 talks about pleasant furniture being taken. Pleasant furniture simply means vessels of desire. And it was referring again to the spoils of war which these Babylonians would take. And verse 10 is a doom verse. It's a doom verse concerning Nineveh. Look at the phrase there. It talks about in verse 10, "Nineveh, she is empty and void and waste." Empty, void, and waste. If you listen to other translations, like the Revised Standard Version, it says desolate, desolation, and ruin. And Moffat's translation, desolate, dreary, and drained. And we know, if you're an English teacher, which, have we got any English teachers in here? I don't think we do, but alliteration, that's what that is, where they use the same letter to give the same sort of a sound three times in a row. And it's the same in the Hebrew. The Hebrew sounds like Hebrew alliteration. Listen to it. It says, "Buka, Mabuka, and Balak." And Buka means empty. Mabuka means void. And Balak means waste. Very similar meanings, but you can see how Nahum is getting the attention of the reader or the listener when he uses this Jewish alliteration to make them aware that Nineveh is a doomed city. Now, Nineveh today, I may have mentioned last time that Nineveh is an archaeological site within the city of Mosul. And my brother-in-law, I believe it was, told me that this was where Saddam Hussein was born. Was that right, Don? Or was it you that told me that? Was, yeah. Okay. Saddam Hussein is in Mosul, or was in Mosul before he was hung. And a city of 1.8 million people, and there's Nineveh, just an archaeological site today, empty, void, and waste, except as a site. In fact, it was empty, void, and waste for 18 centuries. It was lost as of the 2nd century A.D. and wasn't found again until the 1874, when the archaeologist Layard rediscovered the site of Nineveh. The last part of verse 10 is easy to understand when we read about the heart melteth, the knees smite together. These are the people of Nineveh, terrified because of what is going to happen to them. Pain in all the loins, pain in the loins. Compare that to verse 1, where God taunts them through to Nahum and says, "Make thy loins strong," but instead there will be pain in all the loins, and faces gather blackness. We would probably not use that word today. We would say faces go pale. It means the same thing. The blood would drain from their faces, and they would see these masses of red uniforms with spears and swords ready to be used, and the people would be terrified. Now, the last three verses of this chapter talk about lions. The lion's den is destroyed, is what we've put on your notes. As you glance through these last three verses of Nahum chapter 2, notice the lions. Why do you think God instructed Nahum to write about lions? Well, the answer is, again, that God is mocking. Through the prophet, he's mocking the arrogance of the Assyrian kings who dared to blaspheme his holy name. As we mentioned before, I think, it was during the reign of Ashurbanipal II that Manasseh, the king of Judah, was taken into captivity. And when he arrived in Babylon, and he was taken into captivity by the Assyrians, and he was taken to Babylon because Babylon was a province of the empire of Assyria. And he would have seen statues of lions and other gods of the Babylonians and the Assyrians, because they worshipped similar gods. And one of those gods was called Nergal, and he was the Assyrian and the Babylonian god of the underworld. And he was the god of fevers and plagues and other unpleasant happenings. And Nergal in Nineveh is depicted like this. Nergal is a lion with a man's head, a human-headed, winged lion. And on this overhead, which is depicting this treasure, if you like, it's a treasure made of gypsum found in Assyria by the archaeologist Layard in 1845 to 1851. And it's 10 feet, 3.5 inches high, sculptured out of gypsum. And if you want to have a look at it, you have to go to England, to the British Museum, and you'll find it there. Now, the Assyrians believed that their god Nergal, the god of plagues, the god of fevers, mass destruction, the god of disasters, was the reason why they were so effective in war. For example, it was Nergal, according to the Assyrians, that allowed them to defeat Judah. It allowed them to defeat Israel. Nergal allowed Ashurbanipal to remove King Manasseh out of Judah in 650 B.C. and take him to Babylon. And the Bible records this belief in the superiority of the Assyrian gods, such as Nergal, through the taunting words of Sennacherib. Sennacherib attacked Judah in the year 701 B.C., and he taunted God. He taunted the God of Israel. And the God of Israel never forgets blasphemy, and responded 51 years later in 650 BC through the prophet Nahum. Let's go to 2 Kings chapter 18 and have a look at the taunting words of Sennacherib. 2 Kings 18, verses 33 to 35. Hath any of the gods of the nations delivered at all his land out of the hand of the king of Assyria? And then these are the taunting words that Sennacherib told his commanders to say. Where are the gods of Hamath? Where are the gods of Arpad? Where are the gods of Sepharvaim, Hener, and Ivar? Have they delivered Samaria out of mine hand? Who are they among all the gods of the countries that have delivered their country out of mine hand, that the Lord should deliver Jerusalem out of mine hand? Where is the God of Jerusalem? This is what is the taunt of Sennacherib. And God is responding here in Nahum. See what he's saying in Nahum? Verse 11 of chapter 2, where is the dwelling of the lions? Where is the God of Israel? Where is the dwelling of the lions? This is the response. Because the dwelling of the lions, where is the dwelling of the... Nineveh was going to be no more. And apparently in Nineveh there were pet lions, or maybe pet lions is a little much, but lions were roaming around the palace gardens in Nineveh. And the penalty was that all of this was going to be destroyed because the God of Israel was being compared to idols of wood and stone. And they were defeated. Eventually they were defeated. Nahum prophesied they would be defeated. And the Ninevites would not think that their defeat, or attribute their defeat to the God of Israel. They would say, Nergal did it. Nergal, the God of disasters. They would presume that Nergal, the God of disasters, was angry with them and was allowing this Babylonian victory. Now, two other prophets refer to Assyria as having a lion symbol. Let's have a look at Jeremiah for a minute. Jeremiah 50. And at verse 17, both Assyria and Babylon had lions as their symbols. Israel, in verse 17, Jeremiah 50, Israel is a scattered sheep. The lions have driven him away. First, the king of Assyria hath devoured him. And the last, this Nebuchadrezzar, king of Babylon, broken his bones. Therefore, thus saith the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, behold, I will punish the king of Babylon and his land as I have punished the king of Assyria. So that was the order, Assyria first and then Babylon. And God was going to punish them both, these lions that have attacked God's people and God's land. Both empires had this national symbol. The Syrians had the winged lion, as we see on this picture on the overhead. The Babylonians had the lion without wings. And Daniel lived when he was a young boy. He lived in the time of the Assyrian Empire. And then when he got to be a teenager and he was carried away to Babylon by Nebuchadnezzar, he lived in the time of the Babylonian Empire. If you turn to Daniel 7, there's sort of an allusion to that transition period as the Babylonian Empire took over the Assyrian Empire. Verse 4 of Daniel 7, he talks about the four beasts, the four world empires. And here's a transition in verse 4. The first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. There's Assyria. I beheld. So the wings thereof were plucked. It was lifted up from the earth and made stand upon the feet as a man, and a man's heart was given to it. There's Babylon, the Babylonian Empire. So Daniel sort of infers the transition period in his own lifetime as Babylon takes over. Now, if you go back to Nahum and in verse 11, notice the reference to the young lions and the lion's whelp. All of the nations that were allied with Assyria would be considered the young lions or cubs of the old lion. And before the rebellion by Babylon, it was one of those lions. It was a province of the empire of Assyria, and as well as all of the countries from the Persian Gulf to Cyprus, the Tigris Valley to the Nile River. These were all lions, young lions. And then there's the lionesses in verse 12. The lionesses, these were probably the wives and the concubines of King Sin-Sharishkun, who would benefit from the spoils of war. The king would lavish this stuff that he collected on his harem. And in Nahum's day, it was still happening. In Nahum's day, in 650, Nineveh would have been overflowing with booty. And Nahum describes it as filling the holes with prey and dens with ravin in verse 12. Same verse, Nahum uses the phrase, the lion did tear in pieces. And as we said, Ashurbanipal was contemporary with Nahum. And Nahum would have known how cruel Ashurbanipal was. A very successful military man, but very cruel. And this is I guess you would call it the memoirs of Ashurbanipal. He said this: the remnant of the survivors I laid low. I let dogs, swine, wolves and vultures, the birds of the heavens, sweet waterfish, devour their cut-off limbs. So you can just imagine him cutting off arms and legs and of these captives and throwing them to the wolves and the fish, very, very strange man. And the last verse of Nahum chapter 2 is verse 13. It says this: behold, I am against thee, saith the Lord of hosts, and I will burn her chariots in the smoke, and the sword shall devour thy young lions, and I will cut off thy prey from the earth, and the voice of the messengers, thy messengers, shall no more be heard. So this is obviously a message from God to Nineveh through Nahum. And it's not unlike Jonah's message to Nineveh from God. God used Jonah, God used Nahum, and Jonah says, yet 40 days and Nineveh shall be overthrown. And we could look at this book of Nahum and insert a little verse of our own saying, yet 38 years and Nineveh shall be overthrown. That's exactly what happened, because God was about to implement the punishment upon Nineveh that both Jonah and Nahum had warned Nineveh about. They were warned. And he'd been very patient with them. 763 BC, that's when Jonah went into Nineveh. And here it was, 650 B.C. Nineveh, you've got until 612 B.C., and then we're going to get rid of you. 151 years, God was very patient. And then the sword would devour the young lions and anyone else who was supportive of this very corrupt empire. And God would cut off the prey. What does that mean? Cut off the prey. It meant that Assyria's ability to collect all this booty, all the plunder from the neighboring nations, was about to come to an end. And the messengers were not going to be allowed to give their messages like we mentioned. The Sennacherib's message was, where are the gods? And the commanding officers would no longer tell the nations around them to surrender to the Assyrian army, because these messengers, these commanding officers, these people from Assyria would be no more. So what is the 21st century message we can glean from this book of Nahum, this chapter? Well, we've talked about Manasseh a little bit. He was a wicked king in Judah. I believe it was for about a half a century. And God caused him to be chastised by Assyria. What happened? Manasseh repented, and God forgave the horrendous sins of Manasseh. And if God can do that, we can take the message that there's hope for any one of us if we want to get back on track, if we're off the track. There's hope for any one of us. Now, another message, the Assyrians did repent in the time of Jonah. Remember, they did repent for a number of years, but they soon went back to their old way of life. And eventually, God's patience did run out. The Assyrians, in the meantime, were collecting all kinds of booty and any plunder they could get from the surrounding nations they carried off, but they were never satisfied. Never satisfied. They always wanted more. And they stored it in Nineveh only to see it disappear into the hands of the Medes and the Babylonians. So we have to be careful. We should not presume that God will always be patient with us. The Assyrian history and the Israelitish history demonstrates that there is a limit to just how long God can be patient. So if we're in this business of collecting all the booty that this world has to offer, we should be careful, because our appetite may just get out of control, and maybe we will never be satisfied with what we have. So the lesson, I think, that we should learn from the Ninevites is to store up for yourselves treasure in heaven. Instead of guarding our worldly goods, we should concentrate on guarding the hope of Israel. Because God has entrusted that to our care. There's a reference that this is the last message of Jesus Christ himself. He says, "Blessed is he that readeth, and they that hear the words of this prophecy, and keep those things which are written therein." So it's our job to read this book, all of it, and to show that we are hearing what's there, hearing the message by being obedient and having obedient responses to what is said or written. And then this word keep those things which are written therein. It's like a goalie. A goalkeeper guards the net, and what we have to do is guard the truth and preserve the truth that God has given to us and try to deliver that truth to others who may have an interest in the hope of salvation. Thank you.